happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage, Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time, Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough, and last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the editor of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. We are hot on the heels. We are almost putting out Fretboard Journal 45. So if you have yet to subscribe yet, please do. We're having a month-long subscription drive over at thefretboardjournal.com. And we would love it if you would finally join us. You can get a digital subscription for just $29.95, or we have some special tiers that you can check out that are on our homepage right now that include some bonus products, bonus fun stuff. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to Brent Mason, the legendary session guitarist based out of Nashville. Brent has appeared on so many incredible tracks. He is one of the greatest guitar players alive today. And the reason we're talking is because in the Fretboard Journal 45, amongst a whole bunch of other stories, we have a short piece by Steve Krieger, who has written for us over the years. Steve had the kernels of some songs that I think were probably living on his iPhone voice memos, as many of us have. And he decided to take the plunge, fly to Nashville, hire some truly exceptional studio musicians, and really just see what these songs would turn into. It's a fascinating story. We cover a lot of ground. We actually have some very, very cool video that we'll be unveiling soon of the evolution of these songs as well. But Brent was on these tracks, and I wanted to get his take on just the life of a session guitarist in Nashville. I think it's always fascinating for me to hear what goes on down there. And so I hope you enjoy this conversation. He is, as I said, one of the greatest guitarists alive today. So I'm very grateful that he is on this week's podcast. In other news, Roberto Venn once again is sponsoring the Fretboard Journal podcast. For 40 years, Roberto Venn has been training and teaching the next generation of guitar makers. They have an immersive 5-month program where you can basically walk in and leave with some guitars 5 months later and probably a job offer or two from one of the big manufacturers, or maybe set out on your own as a guitar tech or repair person or builder. They also have shorter programs, just weekend-long programs on everything from bracing to pickup winding to pedal building and all sorts of other fun topics. So go to robertoven.com, tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. If you are doing some road trips this summer and want to fill your phone up with as many podcasts as possible, I should remind you that we have a couple of other podcasts in the Fretboard Journal family. The Truth About Vintage Amps with Skip Simmons is another podcast that I host. I can't tell you how fun that podcast is. You just have to check it out for yourself. And if you do, probably start with episode 1 or 2, just because it gets deeper as we go. We're up to episode 17, believe it or not. And also we have Luthier on Luthier. We just posted a new episode of that, which had a ton of interesting food for thought. So check out the Luthier on Luthier podcast, hosted by Michael Bashkin. Okay, without further ado, here's my conversation with Brent Mason. Thanks again, everybody, for tuning into the Fretboard Journal podcast. And I do hope you will subscribe if you haven't yet.
Yeah, hey, Jason.
Is this an okay time?
Yeah, it is. I was doing a morning session and I finished up and I was heading home, but I pulled off here at a little park here.
Safety first.
So I wouldn't have to talk and weave through traffic.
All right.
So, okay.
Yeah, for sure. If you got time, I've got time.
Yeah.
So I should add, I mean, how many sessions are you doing a week these days?
Well, I don't do as many as I used to. I mean, I've been busy this month. This is probably one of the busiest months I've had. But I mean, we were doing some, the last 3 days were, you know, the Brooks and Dunn group, Ronnie Dunn, he's been doing a project, solo project. And I was working on that the last 3 days. And then today I just did a, Dean Miller, Roger Miller's son. Remember Roger
of
Miller?
Of course, yeah, really? Of course.
Great Roger Miller.
Yeah.
He was producing something at this morning, and I wrote the charts. I was kind of a leader on it. I wrote the charts out, and we just finished that up. I was dropping off the time card. But I don't do – we used to pack them in the 90s, you know, in the early 2000s. I used to do about, gosh, two or three every day. You know, now it's you know, some weeks I'll do four or five, or some weeks more, or some weeks, you know, I get a little less, I'll do something else, you know. I don't really have to do as many as I used to.
And I don't want to get too personal, but does the rate change per session, or is it kind of a flat rate based on hours or travel, or how does that work?
I mean, it's you know, I mean, the union, you know, negotiates, you know, and with you know, if the let's see, every year it kind of goes up a little bit, the wage, negotiated, and you know, probably since the 90s it's went up, you know, maybe almost $90 per session.
Okay.
On like master sessions, you know. There's different rates, demo scale, there's a limited pressing scale. You know, there's different scales, like the limited pressing scale would be, since you've opened up a can of worms here, the limited pressing scales for people, you know, are just doing custom sessions, and they're not selling more than like 10,000 records. Probably less now, but, you know, somebody's just opening up their back of their car and selling them, or on gigs, you know, they've got a little table set up or whatever. And then the demo scale is probably it's the less scale, which is publishers writing songs, and they hire musicians and they come in to demo their songs. And then of course they pitch them to artists. And then there's master scales, which is the luxurious budget for record, you know, people doing records on major labels and stuff.
Got it.
So, you know, there's a scale for, you know, for all different entities.
And at this point, you can kind of cherry pick the jobs that sound the most interesting, or the crews that you know the best.
Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah, I can. Yeah, pretty much.
So,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so we had this, I guess it's a story, but it's also a video, this thing that Steve Krieger, our long running contributor, did with involving you. And how do you decide, mm-hmm. how do you decide going into a session like that, what gear to bring?
Well, I'll ask the producer or some, what kind of material we're doing, you know, I mean, and then for the most part, most of the time I'll bring in, you know, if it has cartage, which is, I'll bring in, like a cartage situation, I'll have about 20 or 25 guitars there to, you know, to pick from, you know, because a lot of times in Nashville, or most of the time, we don't know what kind of songs we're doing, or what the artist is, or, you know, we don't really get a heads up on the songs we're doing in Nashville a lot of times. And so if we show up and they want a 12 string guitar, you know, it's good to open up a trunk and grab one, you know.
Sure.
Otherwise, if you're throwing an amp, I think like when we did work with Steve over there, you're talking about that session at Richard Smith's.
Yeah.
I just asked him what kind of stuff we're doing. And I just threw it. I figured, well, I'll throw in a Gretsch and I'll throw in my Tele and bring a Fender Deluxe amp. That should cover it.
Yeah.
and a little pedal board or something, you know.
You mentioned the term cartage. What does that mean?
Oh, I'm sorry. I should explain that. Cartage is, you know, people that cart equipment, music equipment and stuff.
Okay.
You know, they show up with, you know, big trucks and unload the stuff. And, you know, the client will, you know, there's a cartage bill attached to that, of course. And, you know, some of the luxurious things will have a budget for cartage. So the guys show up. I have a cartage company that, you know, I've been to different ones, but the guys that do me now are Drum Paradise. And so they originally started out with drums, but they do other instruments now. So they're still called Drum Paradise, but they're based in Nashville. So I call them up and they'll show up with my equipment. and trunks of guitars and stuff, you know. And of course, I got stuff at home too. If somebody says, "Hey, just jump in here and do something," or we're not paying cartage on this, you know, I'll just throw in a deluxe amp and a pedal board and a couple, three guitars or something, you know.
Yeah.
Something that might cover the gamut, like a Les Paul or a Tele and a Strat or something, you know.
Yeah, and you, so do you keep your instruments with the cartage company, the ones that they can access?
Some of them are. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of them with them, and then I have a lot at home. So, you know, I've got about 40, 50 guitars, you know, laying around. So.
Sure.
And my wife would kick me in the rear end if I brought them all home, so.
Yeah, it's good to spread them out, diversify.
She likes the, you know, the aesthetically beautiful ones, like this orange 6120 Gretsch. Yeah, you can set that one up in the bonus room. That's pretty. But that, you know, that Strat, that ugly Strat with the beer stains and the, you know, and the wood's about ready to fall off of, slide that one under the bed, you know. So
yeah.
I got to deal with that.
And
I understand.
Yeah. Are you at a point where you kind of have everything you need, or are you still looking for stuff all the time?
I got a lot of what I need, but I'm always looking for something. If there's a good bargain or something, if I see an old vintage guitar or something that I'm just aching for, I might have to splurge for it.
Yeah.
Review my finances and and make the big plunge. But, yeah, it's usually old, in, you know, older vintage instruments or something, or amps, you know. I like to, you know, buy stuff that they might need reworked a little bit, but then, you know, ends up being a real, really trusty, great amp. But that's kind of what I do.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not a collector per se, but I like to, I like the older instruments, you know. I mean, with character. And, you know, if it's, something like needs fixing up a little bit, I'll do that. I mean, not myself. I'll take it into, you know, Joe Glazer or
sure.
Something like that.
Got
yeah. I'm not really handy at that. I have to call him up to do most of my work for guitar stuff, you know, setups and repairs and all that.
Yeah. And
yeah.
I guess I'm sort of surprised. Is it assumed that you'll bring an amp with you to a gig, or sometimes do the studios, are they so equipped that you don't even need to bother?
Yeah, sometimes the studios say, "Hey, we got plenty of old amps. You know, we got some twins here. We got Marshall. We got band. We got a bassman. What do you want? We got a Blackface. This." I said, "That sounds good to me." So I'll just show up, you know, and then hopefully the amp works, which
yeah.
I, you know, if it doesn't, then it's my own fault for now. But I do throw in a deluxe in the back of my truck, you know, just in case.
That's smart.
Something doesn't sound good, you know, and that, you know, that's the beauty of those Blackface Fender deluxes, you know, they're not hard to carry around and they sound great.
For sure.
Yeah.
So you're, I think most folks identify you with that, was it a 68 Tele?
Yeah.
Yeah. What are some of the instruments that maybe folks would be surprised to know end up on a lot of sessions that you play?
Oh, just other than that Tele?
Yeah. Other than that one.
Oh, yeah. I've been using, actually there's a white 72 SG Gibson I use a lot.
Really?
It looks like the one on Spinal Tap, mm-hmm. you know, that he plays. And it really sounds great, man. It's a great sounding guitar. It's got a thicker neck on it. You know, it's a lot of wood to grab, but I really love the tone of it. That one, I use a baritone a lot on as a secondary guitar. Sometimes I'll reinforce, you know, some power chords or notes or something with a baritone because it's tuned lower.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, I'll use the Jerry Jones Neptune, or I have the PRS has a good one for a little more like one on steroids a little bit. And then there's a custom builder, Charles Whitfield in Kentucky, that made a great baritone that I use quite a bit. He's lives near Lexington, somewhere out there. He built me one custom. It's beautiful. Sounds great. Looks like a telly, but it's got the long neck on it and stuff.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with him.
You know, it'd be like a baritone, and Les Pauls always come in handy if it's more of a rocking thing. Sometimes, you know, you can't beat a Les Paul solo on something, you know, if you want that humbucker solid body thing.
Yeah.
Gretsch, that 6120 Gretsch I have, it's that Duane Eddy model. I think it was before, pre-Fender. I think I bought it in the early 80s or something. It's orange. Nice. That thing sounds good. I use that a lot. So, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And guitars like that.
And does your pedal board evolve too, or do you kind of have a tried and true setup?
No, I've got like different pedal boards. I like to put them together now. I used to have guys put them together and neatly tie them and tuck them away in there. And then when something would go wrong, where's that cord? I can't fix it. You know?
Yeah.
So I went ahead and said, I'm going to just kind of like put my own together here. So when something goes wrong, I'll know what's up and I'll fix it. So I got like a pedal board that's, you know, kind of a bigger one, and then a mid-sized one, and then a tiny one just to show up for something simple.
Do any
of just analog pedals, you know, yeah, some Wampler pedals. I use that hot wire pedal of mine, that Wampler, you know, the Wampler pedal, hot wire pedal of my signature pedal. I may use the JJ Rocket, the Dude, that pedal a lot. You know, I have more distortion pedals probably than I have anything.
Yeah.
On there. And then just, you know, a Memory Man, like a deluxe Memory Man with a tap delay, and just your average arsenal there, you know. I mean, compressor, delays, maybe a rotospin or something.
Yeah.
I use a Mobius. That's got some pretty good sounds in it, the Mobius. That's all packed into one. Yeah. It's kind of complicated, but it's pretty cool. If somebody wants some effect, it's usually right there, and they sound really decent. So that, you know, that's about what I bring. I don't go too crazy with pedals.
You mentioned the Wampler collaboration. You also have an amp, don't you, that you collaborated with somebody on?
Yeah, Rick Hayes, the Vintage Amp, Vintage Sound. Yeah, we got a 45 watt. It's kind of based from a super reverb, but a little more super reverb meets like a Bassman, and that's just come out. You know, we were tweaking on that, trying to get that thing perfected and stuff, and it's pretty good right now. Use that. I just was trying out different speakers with it at the moment. I'm trying to find the perfect speaker combination with it, since it's you know, an amp head, and I'm trying out different types of speakers to see which one is the perfect speaker right now. So yeah.
Did you do many tweaks to the circuit over the Fender, or any customizations?
Oh, well, I have Jeff Heim here he tweaked a lot of amps of mine. He fixed up a super reverb that's just killer. And that's what got me all pumped up about the 410s, you know, in the super reverb.
Yeah.
And this was like early 70s. It didn't even fire up. It didn't even turn on when I got it. It could have went in the dumpster, and I said, Jeff, can you blackface this one up and make it just a little bit louder than everybody else's super reverb, you know? And he fixed it up. It sounds killer. And, you know, so I love, like I said, I like to buy the old Vintage amps and, Fenders or what, you know, especially Fenders, cause I got about each like Bandmaster, Twin, Deluxe, Vibralux, Bandmaster, Bassman, blah, blah, blah. I love those blackface amps. I just dig them, and they sound great with pedals. you know, it marry up good to pedals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you play out much live?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I do more so now. I usually frequent this and play this club, Third and Lindsley, that I do quite a bit of, you know, lately. They're random things. I mean, it's not like a house. I mean, it's not like a residency or anything, but about once a month I'll play down there with some guys, my material. But I mean, I do a lot of, you know, travel a lot this year to do some clinics and live shows. Seems like more this year have popped up.
Yeah, than
the year prior.
You're doing a ton of teaching, right?
Yeah, yeah. And also I'm doing online Skype lessons. That's a lot of fun. I find I'm kind of like peppering those in a little bit too.
How do those work? How much does it cost to get a Skype lesson from Brent Mason?
Well, it's okay. $200 an hour.
Okay.
And, you know, you get an hour's worth of, you know, one-on-one Skype, and you get a, you know, whether it's like, tabs or video, a little videos at the end, like highlights of what we did. I'll make some, QuickTime videos. We transfer them via WeTransfer to them, and then, you know, they'll have like little bit of pieces of the lesson.
Yeah.
In little files, you know, that they can download, like 3-minute videos or whatever of each lick explained and that. So, you know, that's why you get the most out of an hour, but it's hard to do more than an hour for me or the other guy, the student. It just seems like an hour is about, I'd say 99.99% of everything's all the guys that I've taught it's just been an hour.
Yeah.
2 hours. I don't think I could do 2 hours, be honest. I don't think I could do it, but, it's been a lot of fun, you know, and some guys will make like, I know there's different ways to do that. You can do release videos monthly or weekly or probably, you know, 2 week monthly or whatever. And everybody can subscribe to you know to it. Mm-hmm. But I find it more interesting. It's like sitting down having a beer with the other guy, you know, they're the guitar player, you're talking, you can tell stories, and they seem to really be enthused with that or excited about that they could sit and talk to me and play and interact, you know. That seems to be, because you can see so many videos now on YouTube about anything you want to learn, you know, they're on YouTube somewhere. But it's just the one-on-one interaction, you know, that it seems to make it stand out and a lot more fun.
Yeah.
And appealing to, you know, to the person, to the guitar player.
And you mentioned tab. Are you pretty quick with the tab, or you have software that just kind of spits
out? No, I hate doing tab. I don't like doing it.
Yeah.
But I will do it also, you know, but most people just want the videos, and I think that's the best thing to do.
Sure.
So I just do videos because a lot of stuff is so much in the visual, the looking at the way you're playing it, and you know you get much more dimension out of it. You know, from you can micromanage it a little more and see how you know finger the real complicated stuff. You know, like polyphonic stuff or. Sometimes, you know, like the way Jerry Reed and those guys like that play, it's better to see it, you know, get a good profile, up close look at the neck and stuff. So I'll send those, and I've kind of got that format working for me.
Yeah.
Where I'll just send videos. Oh, there you are. You went to my car phone. I got the Bluetooth all but. Now I'm hearing you on the phone. Hold it a minute.
All right. It did sound different.
Yeah, it's a little echoey that way. I must have hit it with my
There you go.
Chin or something.
You're
there you
back.
Go.
When did all this start for you? When did you move to Nashville?
I moved to Nashville in 83, the summer of 83.
And and what guitars did you have with you, and how good were you?
I was pretty good. I was, you know, just had to learn my how Nashville, you know, you got to learn the little click of Nashville. And, you know, to be professional, you got to play with professional musicians. So, I mean, I had to learn the ropes there. You know, you got all these great, wild kind of guitar licks. And then you need somebody saying, okay, now simmer down and play the song. You know, when you're like 21 years old, you know, you're just full of fire and just overzealous and stuff, you know, playing stuff. And then, you know, you learn about taste and timing. So I went through all that when I came here, because that's, you know, all the great players were here. There's always something to learn, you know.
Yeah, and who was...
You just got to have an open ear and be willing to do it. You can't get too arrogant and complacent.
Who were the, back in those early 80s, who were the Brent Masons? Who were the guys who were getting all the session work?
Well, back, you know, when I came here, it was, you know, Reggie Young.
Yep.
Of course, you know, who we lost, you know, be great, one of the greatest session players that ever lived. Listen to Reggie Young. Steve Gibson was playing a lot of sessions, and Brent Rowan, another Brent, was playing doing a lot of the records in Nashville. So it was Steve Gibson, Brent Rowan, Reggie Young, and another great player we lost not too long ago, Billy Joe Walker,
mm-hmm.
was here doing, you know, and there was Muscle Shoals cats like Larry Byram.
Sure.
That's who were doing them then, you know, had all the, they were the, you know, the A-team.
Yeah.
When I came.
And was it just trial by fire, or did any of these guys kind of shepherd you along and teach you the ropes?
Well, I mean, you know, if you haven't heard, Chet Atkins is the one that gave me the big break.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of parlayed me into the session world. But when he asked me to play on his Grammy award-winning album, Stay Tuned, which that was in the late 80s, I think 87. And he had called me up to ask me if I wanted to play on that, or could I play on that album? And do I have an opening to come in and overdub on it? Of course, you know, I was trying to act cool. I was very, I looked at my calendar. It looked like a snowstorm. I said, yeah, I think that day will work. Yeah, Wednesday's good. Or Thursday. Or Friday. You know, Friday's good, too. I can move some, you know. But anyway, I got to play on that. It was pretty cool. And but that kind of parlayed me into session. I was also writing for, like, CBS songs
mm-hmm.
over there. And learning, you know, the tricks of the trade from a lot of those songwriters, like Keith Stegall and Jim McBride and all those guys that were writing hit songs already. And, you know, so I'd co-write with them, and I thought, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to get this cut. But a lot of the times they'd go, who's playing? Yeah, that's a good song, but who's playing guitar on it? After we demo it, you know?
Yeah.
And I go, oh, that's me. Well, we could use you on this new Keith Whitley record. You know, Garth Fundis said, that's a good song. We'll cut that song, too, but we want you to overdub on the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it kind of moved me right. It parlayed me right into the session world. The songwriting was, you know, doing okay, but it wasn't making me a lot of money. It was a lot of competition and a lot of, you know, rejection as far as songs go. You know, you think you got the perfect song for somebody and it gets thrown out. But I saw the session part of it really coming to light, you know, and all of a sudden I was overdubbing on, like, I don't know, Lee Greenwood and Keith Whitley. Kyle Linning, the producer, was overdubbing me on, like, Dan Seals records and Randy Travis and Kenny Rogers. So originally he wouldn't call me on the tracking day where all the musicians were set around, all the big cats like David Hungate on bass, Larry Lennon on drums, because I was a little young. But he would call me in to overdub all the fills and the lead parts, and by the time the record came out, it sounded like I was all over it. You know, I was the main guy. So it worked out pretty good. But that was Kyle Lenning that sort of gave me the break. And, you know, of course, after doing all those, you know, that it sort of gives you a little boost. And all of a sudden, you know, work's coming in pretty steady.
Yeah. So in the
Keith Stegall is another one that used me a lot, like on, you know, Alan Jackson and all that stuff.
But it sounds like in a lot of those cases, you're never even seeing the star marquee performer, right? You're just going in and doing your job.
Well, no, that was with Kyle. No, yeah, I mean, yeah, most, okay. You know, most of the records, oh, they're there.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, like we were doing, like I said, you know, like back then, Kenny Rogers, he was there, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because they cared about their record, you know. Sometimes we do a Willie Nelson record and Willie wasn't there. But we'd make sure we got the keys and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, because Willie's, sometimes he's got other stuff going on and, you know, two or three different things at once, you know.
Sure.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so like back in the days before the iPhone, how did you keep all these sessions organized? Did you have a hack to know? Did you just have a calendar on you at all times?
Yeah, I had a calendar. I had a, like a, you know, one of those, you know, just a weekly calendar book.
Yeah.
And wrote it down.
All right.
The old fashioned way.
Yeah.
Pre-digital.
At some point in the all this madness, you released a couple of solo albums. Any hope for another solo album from you?
Yeah. You know, I do need to, it's just been so long, you know, and I've been writing songs here and there, but I haven't gotten into do it yet. A lot of times I would get so busy, I just kind of like procrastinate, and that's what I've been doing. But, you know, I plan on a lot of stuff, but I really need to come out with a solo album, and I've been saying it so much I'm embarrassed to even say it, but I mean, I'm going to try to go and record a little bit at a time, you know.
And what kind of sounds is it going to be? Is it going to be jazz or something else?
Yeah, there's going to be, well, if you heard the Hot Word album, it was kind of laced with a lot of different styles, you know. So, it's going to be a little jazz, blues, country, you know, just all those things. And hopefully have a, you know, common thread in it all that's me, my style.
Yeah.
You know, composition, it's hard to follow up a Hot Wired album, you know. So
yeah.
It's somehow it worked. Because I went through a lot of different styles, you know. It was like, hey, it was like pretty erratic. But somehow it worked. I don't know how, but it
definitely
it all
works.
Had
yeah.
a interest, so whatever.
Do you have a home studio, or would you take that to another place?
Well, no, I have a, you know, Pro Tools setup, but I've gotten to where I just hire engineers. I would just be so scatterbrained by trying to engineer and do my own stuff that I just went ahead and, you know, if I had a, you know, I just have a good enough budget to where I can hire an engineer. I'm using this guy, Spencer McGuire, mm-hmm. Who was my stepdaughter's boyfriend, and he just happened to be, a young, great engineer. So a little nepotism there.
Only in Nashville.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I usually just, you know, pay like $35 an hour.
That's not bad.
$40 an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty good. But I mean, I can get things done a lot faster like that rather than trying to. But there's guys that they're much better engineers and technicians than me. I wish I had some of their skills. I could probably, you know, hold on to a little more money that way.
Sure.
But I don't mind it. I like to keep things just the creative side, you know, and not have to worry about all the Pro Tools shortcuts and, oh, I got to call somebody. What's going on here? You know?
Yeah. Well, we're looking forward to that record coming out. So, get cracking on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I will. Well, I got more time to do it now. Let me just say that I got a little more, and it makes more sense to do one now, you know, because I'm kind of like splitting things up a little more. I'm doing more of my own stuff and performances and you know, a lot of times, you know, you're doing a performance and, hey, what you got this, you know, you got any CDs? No, just, you know, the one I did 20 years ago.
Were you kind of burning out on all the session work? Is that why you slowed things down?
Yeah. That was part of it. Just burning out, you know, things get, you know, kind of redundant things, you know, and there's a lot of times my wife and I, I'll go to Hawaii and be there for 2 months or a month or two. And sometimes don't even touch a guitar, but just listen to music without playing.
Yeah.
And then I come back and play better, actually.
Wow.
So I kind of get away from it, you know. It, you know, when you get to be in that workhorse mode, sometimes you just lose the essence of music, and it just, you just get to be too of a perfectionist, and you know, you're being a chameleon, a shapeshifter, they call me. The shapeshifter guy, you know, playing different kinds of things. And then sometimes you just got to go, okay, I'm kind of sick of the guitar for a while. I want to get away from it. I want to hear somebody else. I'm going to listen to some music, you know, so some other inspirations.
What do you gravitate to when you're sitting on that beach in Hawaii?
Well, now here's the thing. My wife, who controls my player in the car, always, you know, from her iPhone or whatever playlist, usually is Steely Dan. Shaka Khan.
Okay.
And I said, that's fine with me. You know, I got a wife who enjoys music and you know, jazz, or she loves George Benson. And you know, she grew up in Nashville. She didn't really listen to country much, but she liked, you know, pop music, good music. She loves, I work with Mike McDonald sometimes, you know, she loves him, the Doobie Brothers.
Sure.
And I say, play all that you want. I love it. So, but if I throw on some Bill Evans, you know, jazz or something, I'll lose her, but I'll have to listen to that by myself. Okay. But she loves, you know, when I'll go back and listen to my Jerry Reed or, you know, in country stuff, I love to dig out some Merle Haggard, you know, she likes that. So
all right.
When I'm in Hawaii, you know, I got to share the playlist a little bit.
she likes the Steely Dan, but Bill Evans is taking it too far. Okay.
Yeah, right. There you go. That okay. Sums it up right there.
Okay. All right. Last question. What's the last gear purchase you've made?
Say it one more time.
What's the last gear purchase you've made? A pedal or a guitar or an amp?
Let's see. I think pedals. I've been buying pedals. I think it was that Mobius pedal I was talking about. I went ahead. I heard somebody using that. I go, shit, I need one of those. So, I bought one of those. I bought another Memory Man. Nothing real far out, you know. There's, I haven't really got into the amp emulator or the amp profiler thing yet. You know, a lot of guys are walking in with these things like a lunch pail, you know, and they set it down and, you know, like the Kemper amps and all that,
sure.
The Fractal, and they're great. I just can't, you know, I could do it and I see where, you know, in your studio and you've set it up, but I can't walk in with one and I just feel totally, you know, in the mercy of the engineer with that, you know, here's my line coming in direct to you until you turn it on. I hear nothing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's a weird sensation. Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that weird? I mean, if you think of it like that.
Yeah.
But, they've just been boutique pedals, anything kind of cool, analog, anything analog, you know?
All right. Well, cool, Brent. This was awesome. Thank you so much for talking.
Okay.
I'm guessing
I hope
you
that
got
made sense. Oh. I don't know. Any of that make sense?
Made a ton of sense. Yeah.
Good. You can decipher that, I guess.